Alright, so at the beginning of Vayechi, Torah mentions that Yaakov had reached the end of his life, basically. Vayikru Yimei Yisrael Lamos. The time of Yisrael, that's Israel, that's Yaakov, had come to die. Which means that he wasn't as yet on his deathbed, because soon after the infant, he calls Yosef and has Yosef make an agreement with him about his burial arrangements. At this point in time, he's concerned about his burial arrangements. And then that's concluded. Then after that matter, if you take a look at chapter 48, it says, Vayomel Yosef, Hine Avicha Chola. Behold, your father is sick, is ill. Then he takes his two sons, and they receive their blessing. So what does it mean that the time, Vayikruvu, Yimei, Yisrael, Lomos, what does that mean, that the time was of his death was near? He wasn't sick. It would seem that he wasn't sick, because after this incident it says that he was sick, and then Yosef comes with Menashe and Ephraim. Basically, the Mefarshim explain that Yaakov was a very realistic individual. It doesn't mean that he knew exactly when he would die, but he sensed, a person can sense, that he's in the last phases of his life. Now, this may not be an absolute science, because you'll always encounter people that were in that kind of a situation. I've known people that were dying from cancer, and soon to me it seemed pretty obvious they were basically finished, just a matter of even days. And I've seen miracle recuperations, and same individuals are years later still around. So this is not necessarily an exact science, but as far as Yaakov was concerned, he was very realistic, and he realized that he's very weak and his life is, so to speak, ebbing away. That doesn't mean he was on his actual deathbed, but he knew that he didn't have much time left, and this was the time to deal with the situation. So then he calls for Yosef. Of course, one can ask, why, what about the rest of the brothers? He calls for Yosef, and it seems that this arrangement is made simply between him and Yosef, which would seem the reason would be that what he's going to request can only be accomplished by the individual who's in a position to do so, the power. So the authority, of course, was with Yosef to receive permission from Paro and to make the arrangements to have him transferred after all the mourning was done in Egypt. You see from this, by the way, the extensive description of the eulogies and the mourning for Yaakov. It's an amazing kind of a phenomenon. The amount of days that he was mourned in Egypt, and then the embalming period, then the delegation of dignitaries that accompanied the body through the Sinai, then even, this is already months after he died, then on the other side of the Arden, Gorin HaOtad, they spent 7 days, another 7 days of eulogy, and people who saw it were amazed by it. This is something which really is hard to grasp. You don't see that phenomenon. I'm not aware of anything like that. Even great leaders and dignitaries, Kennedy assassination, there was a tremendous period of mourning, but I don't remember that extensive, that many days of mourning, that many days of eulogy. So this is an interesting phenomenon. So Yaakov entreats him, and Nomad says, if please I have found favor in your eyes, place your hand under my thigh. All of that is for the sake of an oath. And please do for me chesed and emes, compassion and truth. That's how he describes it. Al nosik v'reini b'mitzrayim. Please do not bury me in Egypt. V'shachafti em avosai, when I die, literally when I lie with my fathers. Unasasani Mitzrayim, and you shall carry me from Egypt, Ukvartani Bikfurasam, and bury me in their burial place. As we know, the Miaras Machpelah. But Yomar, he said, Anochi Esa Kidvaracha. I'll do exactly as you say. So, Yosef agreed to do it. What happens next? Vayomer, and Yaakov said, he shavali, swear to me. Vayishavalo, and he swore to him. Vayishtachi Yisrael al Rosh Hamita. And Yaakov bowed, so to speak, by the head of the bed. There's a number of questions that we can raise. I'm not taking up all the questions. What I found interesting, for example, is he wants a favor. He's asking him for a favor. Well, that's the question. Is it a favor or is it justice? He seems to refer to it as chesed. Chesed would seem to imply that it's a favor. But then he says ve'emes and truth. What does that mean? What is chesed and emes? Favor and the truth. If it's truth, then I would assume that it's something that one ought to do. That's justice. It's the right thing to do. If it's the right thing to do, so then why is it chesed? So therefore we need to know, in terms of the request of Yosef, on what basis is it being requested? Which I think is significant. If somebody asks me to do something, so I would like to understand what the basis is. Are you asking me for a favor? Or you're asking me to do something which I really have an obligation to do? I don't think that it's both. If it's an obligation, it's not a favor. And so on. That's one issue. As far as the reason behind it, it seems that there's two factors over here. Because the Torah makes a point, please do not bury me in Egypt. But the real objective is to bury me in the Maris HaMachpelah. Well, I'm not sure if that he's really promising two things, or he's promising one thing. If he fulfills the promise, then obviously if he buries him in the Maris HaMachpelah, so he's not going to bury him in Egypt, we know that. But is it a separate idea that don't bury me in Egypt, even if you can't make it to the Maris HaMachpelah? Don't bury me in Egypt, that's one idea. Or that's the idea. If you can't bury me for whatever reason, because it is possible that he won't be able to do it. It's possible. Even though he took an oath, it's possible he won't be able to do it. So then, okay, bury me in Egypt. It's only one idea. If it's one idea, then one can ask, why is there an emphasis over here? Please do not bury me in Egypt. I mean, Rashi, the Mefarshim, explained that there are two ideas over here. Perhaps this is the resolution. See, it seems to me that it's not two separate oaths. It's one oath. The oath that he's taking is to see that he's buried in the Maris HaMachpelah. And if for whatever reason he can't do that, then I don't know that he's really bound by any other oath. But Rashi mentions, among the various reasons of why he didn't want to be buried in Egypt, Rashi sees fit to give reasons for that. So you see that there is an idea of just not being buried in Egypt. Now one of them is because he's concerned that the Egyptians will use his burial place as some kind of a shrine. He'll be worshipped over there. The third reason mentioned by Rashi is that the Egyptians should not render him into an avodah zarah, into an idol. We can learn a very important point from this. This shows the greatness of Yaakov, that Yaakov, all of the others, were concerned for the benefit of all mankind, to lead people to the truth. So insofar as the Mitzrayim are concerned, insofar as the Egyptians are concerned, he wanted his life, what he stood for, to be a source of enlightenment, that people can learn from it. But the danger would be that they'd be overwhelmed by the emotions. These are the emotions that people go when they encounter someone who appears to them to be great, so they project all kinds of properties. That's what people are searching for. People are searching for a God that they can relate to in terms of their emotions, that gives them a certain emotional comfort. The idolization of Adam, projection of the deification of man, That hasn't left us. That exists with us today. And unfortunately, there are many religious leaders, charlatans, who really promote that type of thing. Whether they come out overtly or not overtly, but they are trying to establish a relationship in which their followers look up to them and magnify them and attribute powers to them. I think that there is another element. That is, one is its concern for the Egyptians, that he should not be a stumbling block and be a cause for people to stumble into idolatry. Aside from that, it's also in terms of the idea that he represents, that he needs to be associated with the true idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's one of the Avos. So the fact that some people will look at him in a different way will diminish from the proper image that he's supposed to reflect. It would tarnish the image to a certain extent. To clarify, if you have a great individual that reflects a certain idea, as opposed to a different sect that reflects that the wrong ideas, if both of those groups will adopt that person as their leader, as their role model, so it's going to detract. It's going to detract from the correct, the ones who have the correct notion, except him, he's the role model of the correct way of life. Then there's others who have a defective attitude, the idolatrous approach. They also regard him, so then people, it'll diminish the whole idea of what he stood for. The question that I want to focus on is the idea of the Shvuah, of the oath. That is, why did Yaakov find that it was necessary to force Yosef to take an oath after Yosef had given his word? It's a simple question, but I think it's a very significant question. Take a look at the end of the parasha. The final event that's recorded is that Yosef requests of his brothers that when God remembers the Jewish people, in other words, when God takes the Jews out of Egypt, they should remove his bones from Mitzrayim, and they should be buried in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. That's in chapter 50, the Nun, Chavdal, Vayom Yosef Alechav. Yosef said to his brothers, Anochi Meis, I'm going to die. Same sense of honesty and realism. Velakim Poko Yifkod Eschem, and God will remember you. Vehela Eschem Min Ha'aret Hazos, and bring you up from this land. El Ha'aret Eshenishpa Liavram Liyasok Liyakov, to the land that he promised to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I don't think he means literally to the brothers themselves. I don't think that he thought that this would take place within a short amount of time. But here he's talking to them as the forerunners or the leaders of the Jewish people. So what does it mean? I mean, actually, his bones were removed by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was the one who did the mitzvah. And that was when the Jews left Mitzrayim, but that's not going to take place for a couple hundred years. So was Yosef wrong over here? Did Yosef, who was he talking to? He thought that the brothers would be removed by God from the land of Egypt in a short period of time? That's very, very difficult to imagine. So therefore it seems that he means that the brothers representing the Jewish people at that time, such as they were, in formation, should take upon themselves this obligation and do what? And transmit it to the next generation, and it's a collective responsibility, something that the Jewish people took upon itself, and preserve it and transfer it, because the day will come when you'll be removed, and when that happens, I'm asking you to remove my bones and bury them in the land of Canaan. Then the question arises, did he rely on their word, or did they take an oath? The point is being made that Yosef did not make the same request that Yaakov had made. Yosef didn't make a request that they should bury him in Canaan. That, I think, we can understand because of two things. First of all, Yosef was the great hero of Egypt, and even the idea of allowing Yaakov to be buried outside the country was not a small thing. You see the reverence that the Egyptians had for Yaakov. It's more than that. It's a practical thing that every nationality, every country wants to magnify itself, make itself great. One of the ways in which it makes itself great is by who the great people that, and they want to make them actually even Egyptians. Even the Rambam has been preserved in Egyptian history. Because since he's a great individual, known the world over, they want to take the credit. So, any country is like that. Even if a person wasn't a Native American, if he lived here and he did his work here, so it's part of our pride. Now, the idea of where he's buried is very significant. Because that makes it a permanent thing. He's associated with his country, and if you want, you can go to his burial place, and then he becomes a part of our heritage. So that was a problem with regard to Yaakov. That's why there was an anticipation that it would not be easy. The Egyptians would want him to be buried in Egypt, make it part of Egypt's history. Yaakov didn't want to do that because he wanted to be buried in the Maris HaMakpelah. That's an extremely important idea. That for the Bnei Yisrael, the Maris HaMakpelah, that the idea of the association of this land with the Avos, that's what gives us the right to the land. God gave the land because of the Avos. God chose the Jews because of the Avos. And we're the descendants. And the objective of Eretz Yisrael is to establish a society that's living in accordance with that lifestyle of the Avos. That's extremely important. That's why he had to be there. I would say that it would not have been possible for Yosef to achieve that he could be buried over there. Because of two things. Yosef had nobody to intercede for himself. He wasn't going to do that. I guess that would be too difficult. His entire life, everything was in Egypt. He had been kidnapped at an early age. And then he had risen in power. He was on a par, on a level with Paro and everything. It's just, I think it would be extremely difficult for him to make that request. Of course, if he couldn't make the request, then clearly none of the brothers could make the request afterwards. And besides, there was nobody after him that had that kind of clout, that had that kind of influence with Paro. But aside from that, the question would be, the only person that could have secured such an agreement, an arrangement, would have been Yosef. Yosef would seem to me did not want to do that, because that would not leave a very pleasant effect. Also, bear in mind that Yosef realized that after he was gone, what would be left to protect the brothers? He was the one who protected them. Then he'd be gone. And now he'd have to rely, the family would have to rely upon the fact that the Egyptians, their honor, that they had brought the family down, they had given them certain rights, and all of those things. But it was the association to Yosef, the memory of Yosef, the relationship, the association to Yosef, which would be the factor which would impel the Mitzrayim to treat the Jews properly, as long as they remembered Yosef. In fact, it's pointed out in Shemos that once that entire generation died, so the connection to Yosef wasn't strong anymore of the Jews at the time of Paro who enslaved them. So it means that with the passage of time, the association back to Yosef diminished. In fact, a new king arose, Ashalo Yodas Yosef, didn't know Yosef. That whole association was weakened. But clearly, as far as Yosef was concerned, he didn't want to do anything to break the connection. And therefore, by being buried in Egypt, having a significant national burial place for Yosef, that would keep the story of Yosef alive. That would be vital for the protection of the family. However, when everything fell apart, then the Jews were enslaved, and then God intervened. When the time came to uproot the entire settlement of the Jews in Egypt and go to Eretz Canaan, then he wanted to be taken with them. In a sense, Yosef needed to be there, buried there, to keep the memory of what he did alive as a protection for the family. The word as translated by Unkelus, by Yashba Yosef, is the Omi Yosef. And the translation of that is that he administered an oath. He was the cause. Vayashba. He caused them to take an oath, means he administered an oath. So we see that Yosef did the same thing. But let's see if we can understand what's going on over here. The question still remains, though, that why would it be necessary? Let's take the case of Yaakov first. Why would it be necessary to have Yosef take an oath after Yosef had given his word? I want to turn to a Gemara, interesting Gemara, which I think is very, very important, not just for the sake of studying Gemara, but a lesson that's relevant to our time. It has to do with the subject of giving one's word. And I think that, especially in this society, people do not take it too seriously. Of course, everybody will maintain you shouldn't lie, outright lie, but a lot of times people give their word without making a promise. There's different categories. Oh, did I promise? Did I swear? But if I just said I would do something, some people, if you say it's significant. The idea of making a commitment. Are you permitted to just give your word, even if you didn't swear, and then break it? The Gemara in Kedushin, Daf Mem Hei Amud Beis, talking about the subject of a girl when she's a katana, when she's a minor, before the age of 12. At that point in time, the father has the power to arrange a marriage for her. Of course, as we learn, that's something which is not supposed to be utilized, except in extenuating circumstances. In general, it's not a good idea, and it was only used in circumstances when it was very difficult for the Jewish people because of the situation, of oppression, and so forth, and it was necessary to secure a husband. At that time, could be to protect the girl, or the father at that time had the money. In those days, you had to have a dowry, and you didn't know what would happen later, whatever the situation. So the Gemara here is obviously is discussing all the ins and outs. The Gemara is discussing that subject and talks about a case where the father of the girl, there was a girl was a minor, and the father had mentioned to a relative of his, on his side, you know, that he gave him permission to marry her. And the mother had given permission to her relative. So there was a difference in opinion between the husband and wife. Husband and wife. Right. So then the girl says that she pressured. So the mother then went ahead and pressured her husband to give in. Okay. And he agreed to give the daughter to her relative. Then it says V'asu Sa'uda. Then they made a party, I guess an engagement party, whatever the case is, and they invited all the relatives. So the one that he wanted was there as well. So, while they were eating and drinking at the party, so the one that he wanted, the young man, was with the girl upstairs in one of the rooms, and he was Mekadesh her. A proactive young individual.
He with
Adam and everything? Yeah, with Adam. But what's the halacha? The halacha is, in a situation like that, if someone marries or gives kedushin to a katana, that could be a problem. But it's only valid if it's in accordance with the will of the father. If the father didn't want it at that time, because you need the permission of the father. So if we know that the father wanted this person, and he goes ahead and he's mekadesher, so it's going to be kedushin. If the father didn't want it, so then it doesn't help, because she can't receive the kedushin of her own accord. It's got to be the power to render the transaction is vested in the father. Amar Abaya said, "Ksiv she'eris Yisrael al yaso avla." The remnant of Israel will not do anything which is unseemly, which is unjust. Avla, v'lo yidabru chazav, and they don't speak deceitfully, which means to say that he gave his word. He gave his word to his wife. Rashi says, Lo yasu avlo. Do not do anything which is crooked. Velo chayshian b'ha. And we're not concerned. Sheminis ratzo ha'av. That perhaps the father was favorable, accepts the Kedushin. Delo hodar bay midibure. We don't suspect that he changed from his word. He gave his word. If he gave his word, so that's it. So that's not the Kedushin. The Kedushin is in accordance with his word. Therefore, according to Abaya, the Kedushin doesn't count. The reason I'm bringing this up is because this seems to be like something which is pretty trivial. People do not generally believe that if they gave their word, that they're bound to it, in that sense, in this kind of a strict sense. That is to say, well, if a person says they'll do something, if I make up to do something, so unless it's really serious in terms of you, the consequences, or you know that someone is counting on you, or they, you know, they asked you a few times, if you mean it, you really a promise. But just the mere fact that you said you would do something, I don't think the person feels obliged to do it. Purely because of MS. But this is the pasuk, this is the kedusha of Klal Yisrael, it seems to me. This is a part of the sanctity of Klal Yisrael. In terms of MS, in terms of living a life in accordance with truth. If you give your word, are you obligated to do it? In pursuing this subject, I guess we have to be reasonable. I don't mean to be unreasonable. As someone is saying, let's say that there's things that we say, like, I'll call you back later because you're busy and you can't talk now. And then you're still busy and things came up and you couldn't call back later. I would say that you have to use intelligence in these areas. Because in the context of making that statement, so it's understood what you meant. I'm not saying that we shouldn't consider that. Every relationship has a certain context, and people have a way of speaking. And therefore, in that situation, when you were very busy, and you said, I'll call back later with all good intention, but everybody realizes, and that doesn't mean that you're absolutely bound to do it, that you gave your word. You have to take things in their proper context. However, in a situation like that, if you do have the time and nothing came up, you just don't feel like it, then you have a question, but you said you would do it. So to a certain extent, you're not being truthful. However, beyond that, even in a situation where people do say that they'll do such and such, they then begin to think it over. How important is this? Am I really obligated to do it? Did I promise? Oh, I didn't promise. All right. So you can forget about it. In that framework, people say a lot of things that they're going to do. We should get together. We're going to get together. All types of things which they don't really mean. Or at the time they said it, they really did mean it. But then when it comes time to do it, they don't feel the same way that they felt when they actually said it. That seems to be a problem. In this situation, he said, well, this wasn't just saying in a general way. He made an agreement. He agreed in terms of who the chassan would be. But he didn't promise. He didn't take a shul. But that's his word. We're assuming now. This is all based on assumption. We don't have any proof. But we know that the Kedushin is no good because since She'er is Yisrael, the remnant of Israel does not speak falsely. That is to say, when a person gives their word, that's their bond. They're bound by their word. That's why the Torah criticizes, as we pointed out, the Sarah Mashkim, that he didn't mention Yosef. There it doesn't seem that he promised. The Torah does not even record that he said he would do it. But by implication, by the fact that he did not tell Yosef, he left Yosef with that impression that he would do it. He had an obligation to do it, and he didn't. He didn't keep his word. I would like to point out, I think it's very important in terms of children, that parents do a lot of things that contradict their own ideas that they try and teach the children. And one of them, I think, is in this area. I think parents, when children are annoying them or bothering them and they don't have patience, so they'll always, okay, I'll do this, we'll do it tomorrow. We'll take care of that tomorrow. They're always saying things along those lines, and then when tomorrow comes, well, you know, something came up, that kind of thing. thereby transmitting the idea to children that one doesn't have to go in accordance with one's word. That it's a thing of convenience. That's not a good idea. A person should not just give their word unless they intend to keep it. Now, we're not all perfect. We're not machines. There will be times when you do say, in all honesty, I'll call you back later, and then things come up, and the friend understands. Everything has to be done with seichel. But by and large, people, there is a tremendous amount of phoniness in this society in terms of flattery and praising people if you don't really mean it, feeling one way, and behind their back you say one thing. But there's also a tremendous amount of a freedom, of looseness with words, where people say all kinds of things that they're going to do, and then they don't feel that because they said it, they have an obligation to do it. That's something which, it seems to me, this is part of the Kedusha of Israel. The holiness of the Jewish people, in the sense that She'eris Yisrael, that the remnant of Israel do not speak falsely. So their word is their bond. Now, if that's the case, I think the question becomes even stronger with regard to Yaakov, that why didn't he accord Yosef this respect? He gave his word. It's also interesting to note that the extent to which they had trusted Yosef, would Yaakov have gone down to Egypt and brought the entire family and placed themselves completely under the control of Yosef on the basis of Yosef's promises? He didn't take a shvuah. He told them, I'll take care of you, I'll feed you, and so on and so forth. He kept his word. So you see that he's kept his word on all these issues. Why would he demand that he take an oath at this point? The answer is, as the Ramban points out, the Ramban was troubled by this issue. So the Ramban on Lamed Aleph, that's 31, where Yaakov says, swear to me, and he swore unto him, he says that Yaakov did not suspect his son, the tzaddik, the righteous one, Ho'ohav lo, the one that he loved, that he would violate the command of his father. And on the matter that he promised to do. And he said, Anochi Yetzak Edvarecha. He calls that a promise. That's a promise. So there's a difference between a promise and an oath. Promise means I agree to do it. Therefore, it's not really necessary, it shouldn't be necessary to say, do you promise? The person says they're going to do something, an honest individual, so that's it. But he says he did this to strengthen the matter in the eyes of Paro. Perhaps he would not give him permission to separate from him. Or he would say that to send your brothers and your servants. Or that Paro would desire that the prophet should be buried in his land for their honor and their benefit. Therefore he made him take an oath, because it would not be proper for Paro to cause him to violate an oath. And you see, it's an interesting phenomenon. I just want to expand on it a little bit. That according to this, Yaakov understood the climate in which Yosef would have to make the request. If you study the Pesukim carefully, you'll see that the balance of power had shifted. Because after Yaakov dies, when the time comes to make the request, if you take a look at chapter 50, Pasuk Dalet, that's 4. After the days of crying for Yaakov, the public mourning had finished. It says that Yosef spoke to the house of Paro and said, please, if I found favor in your eyes, please speak to Paro for me. That's an amazing thing, that Yosef had to beseech them to intercede with Paro. That means that his status had diminished, because at the very beginning, when he was appointed, he said, you'll be over my household. Right? Chait made that observation. In the original scheme of things, Yosef was second in command. He didn't have to go through any intermediaries. What happened now? Now he doesn't go directly to Paro. He asks them to intercede. That indicates that his position had deteriorated to a certain extent, which makes perfect sense. Because as the memory of the catastrophe that he had saved them from, as it diminished, it got weaker, so then, what have you done for me lately? That type of an emotion begins to set in. So he wasn't as powerful as he was. And this is the request. Avi Yishpiyani Lema, my father caused me to take an oath, saying, Hinei Anochi Meis, Bekivri Asha Karisi Liberitz, Kenan Shamatik Vireni. So Yosef presents it to them that he took an oath. Tell Paro that I took an oath. My father made me swear that I would bury him in the burial place of in Kenan. And now he's asking for permission. So why was it necessary in terms of Paro? Because if he would merely say that I promised my father, then Paro could look at it differently. But Paro wouldn't understand that concept of speech, that if you give your word, you're bound. Then he could have said, all right, you gave your father your word, you're sincere, you're honest, but things have changed. You know, you tried your best, and right now the situation is that we need you here, you can't go, whatever reason. It wouldn't have the same effect upon Paro. Because, all right, you gave your word. All things being equal, you'll try. That means you'll try. Try your best. You tried your best, and it didn't work out. That's how most people look at it. But even Paro would understand an oath. I made an oath to my father concerning his burial place. I can't live with myself if I don't keep that oath. You see, everybody respects the idea of an oath. That's why you find even in court to swear him in. The use way to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. It's an oath. But one second, without the oath, the person's going to lie? Well, yeah, people will lie. That's the idea. But what the Ramban is saying is reinforcing our position that Yaakov did not need the oath in terms of himself, in terms of his belief in Yosef, because if Yosef gave his word, that was sufficient. But as far as Paro was concerned, it's a different idea. As far as Yosef and the brothers are concerned, if the term over there, Vayashpa, means that he administered an oath, of course one can raise the question, what was necessary? Because here he's not dealing with Paro. Here he's dealing with his own brothers, who are Jews. And if She'eris Yisrael, Yasa Avel, the remnant of Israel, V'lo Yidab Ruchazav, does not speak falsely. I would say because that's a different situation. There, it was a different kind of a request. It's something which they themselves couldn't guarantee. They were not going to be the ones to carry it out, but it meant to say that they'd have to pass this down. This would have to be transmitted. So that the ones that eventually would have to do it would not be the ones who were giving the word. It becomes a national responsibility. If you're talking about a national responsibility, so then it has to be in the form of an oath. Because you're not going to have any person who gave his word. Who gave the word? That means to say it's like the Torah. When God gave the Torah, it was given with olos, with oaths. It's part of a covenantal phenomenon. So that's a different type of a thing. But if Yosef was asking the brothers to do something that they themselves had the power to do, so then if they give their word, if they promise, that would have been sufficient. Just to conclude, I had an additional thought, because I'm making the point that this is not just the right thing to do. This is part of a person's perfection. A person's entire relationship to the truth is affected by how they adhere to this. Mitzvah sheket tircha, to stay away from something which is false. Now, of course, we're living in a society, and you've got to be intelligent. As I said, there are things you get into conversation, something comes up, and you tell your friend, "I'll call you back later," and because you were thinking that you'd have the opportunity, then you didn't. obviously, I mean, that's okay, that's acceptable. You got to be normal, you got to be reasonable. But there are many times where we use this as a device, we say things, and we really don't have the intention of keeping them. That should be regarded as an element of sheker, of falsity. And midvar sheker terchak, a person should stay away from that. That is, if a person says that they are going to go somewhere, if they're going to come to a minyan, or if they're going to go to a class, in a context where they're saying they're going to come and they're sincere, then they have to come, basically. Otherwise, it's sheker, it's false. Now, obviously, if something comes up and you get sick or something else, whatever, so that's a different situation, because it's understood in that context. That's the difference between just saying you're going to come and making a shvuah. Once you take a shvuah, it becomes an absolute. But I think many people do not have that attitude, that if they say they're going to do something, and even if they didn't take an oath, they said they're going to go to a class, or they agreed to come to a minyan, or things of that sort, they sort of feel, well, it depends on how I feel, that there's much more wiggle room over there. Then even if you really could have gone, but you weren't in the mood to go, well, I wasn't in the mood. So why'd you say you're going to go? There's a gap over there. A person's sense of truthfulness, of being in line with reality, of being in line with emes, with truth, would demand that a person either don't say you're going to come, because you don't have to do that. Well, once you do that, then too bad. I said, I'm going to come. Yeah, there is a commitment. There is a, that's what Sheher Shalom. There's a commitment. There's no commitment, then what's that whole idea of the Gemara? Where with the, it's assumed that the father gave his word to the to his wife, and that's the one who he is going to agree to in terms of who the husband will be. I was just thinking that it's interesting because we always were familiar with the Medrash that says that God went to all the nations and asked them if they wanted the Torah. And, you know, each one refused. They wanted to know what it entails, and they refused. Except the Jews said, Naaseh v'nishma. We will do and we will hear. So I'm just thinking, well, anybody could have said that. Is the idea that the Jews are distinct because they said? Well, no, but not just that they said, but their word had value in the eyes of God. That is to say that when they said, we will, Naaseh v'nishma, we'll do and we'll listen, so that meant that it was accepted, that God accepted their word. Their word had value in the eyes of God. Because anybody could say it, what difference does that mean? But you're dealing with people who, when they give their word, it has a significance. That's the idea of Naaseh v'nishma. Not just that they said it, but they said it and they meant it, and that had value. That was truth.